Imperial airships would bring the far-flung peoples of the British Empire closer together than ever before. Every day, blimps would slip their masts near London, carrying passengers and freight, bound for Montreal, Cairo, Karachi, Singapore, and Sydney. Journeys that had once been measured in months would breeze past in days. The Imperial Airship Service would bind Canada, Australia, South Africa, Egypt, India, and New Zealand into a true global superpower. Britannia still ruled the waves, but now she would dominate the sky. These dreams were dashed when the world's largest airship ploughed into the ground in northern France on its inaugural flight to India. Britain's Hindenburg disaster ended an imperial flirtation with airships. Did it also deal a blow for the future of the British Empire?
I'm Ian Chapman Curry, and this is the Almost History podcast. Throughout time, people have made choices that have changed the world. We tend to focus on successful plans, projects that prospered, and inventions that worked. But sometimes the most interesting stories are found in history's what-ifs and near misses. This podcast looks at this almost history, the unrealizable utopias, cancelled operations, and impractical visions, to try and find out what could have been. You can find out more about the series and get in touch at almosthistorypodcast.com.
Each episode digs into the background, imagines what the alternative future could have been like, and explains why it didn't quite turn out like that. This week, what if the British had succeeded in launching a safe and commercially viable Imperial Airship Service? The British Empire reached its territorial zenith in the 1920s. Vast swathes of the globe were shaded pink, from Ellesmere Island in the far north of Canada to the British Antarctic territories in the further south. In between, a quarter of humanity lived under the Union flag in places as diverse as India, Australia, Nigeria, and Cyprus. The sheer size and immense distances created some of the biggest challenges for imperial administration. It took up to 6 weeks to sail to Sydney. Even with the Suez Canal, it still took the fastest liners up to 4 weeks to reach India. After the horrors of the First World War, the question of imperial defence was high on the political agenda. But how could you shrink these vast distances? In 1921, a proposal was made to the Imperial Conference to radically reduce journey times. The idea was put forward by Mr. Ashbolt on behalf of Tasmania, one of the Empire's furthest flung territories. Mr. Ashbolt proposed an Imperial Air Company with funding to come from India, Australia, South Africa, New Zealand, and the Malay States. Under the plan, Britain would work with France and Greece to link London to Marseille, Athens, and Cairo. Just as the Suez Canal was integral to maritime transport, Cairo would become a hub for airships. From Egypt, blimps would either fly due south or southeast. The southern trunk line would connect African cities from Cape to Cairo via Mombasa. The southeastern leg would see airships reach Karachi or Bombay, Colombo, Singapore, Java, Perth, Melbourne, Sydney, before reaching up in Wellington. The fastest liners needed 4 weeks to reach India via the Suez Canal. In the same luxury, the airships would glide there in just 5 days. A round trip to Australia would be slashed from 3 months to under 3 weeks. It was an enticing prospect, and it was made even more compelling when British ministers looked across the North Sea and saw the advances being made by Germany's Zeppelins. By the time of the Imperial Conference in 1921, the Deutsche Luftschifffahrtgesellschaft had already made 103 flights. Was Britain really going to allow her recently defeated foe to take such a lead in the air? Eventually, the Tasmanian plan was abandoned, but the idea was taken up again in 1922 by engineers and aircraft manufacturers Vickers. This became known as the Burney Scheme, after its creator, Denniston Burney. The Burney Scheme envisaged a flight to India every other day and a weekly service to Australia. In total, 6 airships would be built at a cost of $4 million. This is roughly equivalent in today's terms to the government embarking on a project costing well over £1.5 billion. The project left the imagination only to become enmeshed in years of preliminary planning, parliamentary committees, and cost-cutting. It took the passion and vision of the Labour Air Minister, Lord Thompson of Cardington, to get the project moving again. He abandoned the Burney Scheme, and in its place inaugurated the Imperial Airship Scheme. He had lofty aims and wrote about them in The Observer in 1926. The Imperial Airship Scheme was to give a unity to widely scattered peoples, unattainable hitherto, to create a new spirit, and to inculcate a conception of the common destiny and the mission of our race. In addition, there was a growing recognition of the importance of air power in home defence and throughout the British Empire. In the end, the Air Ministry decided to proceed with 2 competing projects. The first was christened His Majesty's Airship R100 and was to be built by the Airship Guarantee Company. R100 was privately financed and adopted a more conservative design. His Majesty's Airship R101 was backed by the Ministry of Air. It was to be a very different kind of airship than its private sector sister. In the official report of the R101 inquiry, the investigator, John Simon, commented that the designers broke away almost completely from conventional methods and in every direction an attempt was made to improve upon standard Zeppelin practice. Given the turbulent political times, it was perhaps inevitable that the R100 became labelled in the press as the capitalist ship, whilst the government-backed R101 became the socialist ship. The project stalled again when the Labour Party were thrown out of power. Momentum returned to the project when Lord Thompson resumed his position in the Air Ministry following Labour's 1929 election victory. A further imperative came from recent German successes. In 1929, the Graf Zeppelin completed an audacious round-the-world trip, flying from Lakehurst in New Jersey to Friedrichshafen in Germany and then on to Tokyo via Moscow. The last leg took the German ship over the Pacific to Los Angeles and back to Lakehurst. This was around the world in 21 days, and it was a huge publicity coup for Germany and the Zeppelin company. The race was now on to get concrete signs of British success ready for the Imperial Conference to be held in 1930. And, as far as the Air Ministry was concerned, that meant completing a return flight to and from India before the end of October. And it meant flying R101 before a comprehensive set of checks had been finished. Remarkably, the inaugural flight would be joined by an array of VIPs. The passenger manifest included the Secretary of State for Air himself, Lord Thompson, and Sir Sefton Branker, the Director of Civil Aviation. Joining them would be Squadron Leader William Palstra of the Royal Australian Air Force, Reginald Comore, the Director of Airship Development, and 2 of his key engineers, Lieutenant Colonel Richmond and Michael Rope. Perhaps they'd all been reassured by the airship's sheer size and spaciousness. R101 had significantly more passenger space than today's Airbus A380. The airship itself was huge. At 732 feet long, it was like an ocean liner floating in the sky. She was also much taller and wider than those ocean-going behemoths. No one who saw R101 gently swaying whilst tethered to her mast would forget the sight. But with the fate of RMS Titanic in living memory, no one should have been taken in by sheer scale or the reassurances of man conquering the elements. R101's Certificate of Airworthiness was hastily issued on the 2nd of October 1930. She was scheduled to take off 2 days later. A last photograph shows Lord Thompson, Sefton Branker, Lieutenant Colonel Richmond and Squadron Leader Ernst Johnson, R101's chief navigator. They're smiling with the looming frame of the airship behind them. Several thousand people were reported to have lined the roads around the aerodrome to watch the spectacle. They lit the fields with the headlights of their cars and let out a cheer when the nose of the airship slipped away from the mast. R101 took with her the hopes and expectations of millions around the empire. A clear voice rang out across the terminal. Imperial Airship's voyage to Sydney via Cairo, Calcutta and Kuala Lumpur will be ready for boarding in approximately half an hour. Will all passengers for flight R116 please assemble at gate number 4? The same announcement was then read in French. From across the terminal, people emerged from shops and cafes and made their way to the gate. The Thompson Terminal was one of the most opulent places she had ever seen. She'd travelled around Europe and had even made short flights to the continent from Croydon Aerodrome, but this was something else. From the outside, the building had the look of King's Cross Station. Two towers framed a central arch that spanned the main concourse. But unlike King's Cross, the towers repeated themselves 12 times down a much longer expanse. And the towers were much more elegant, curved buttresses with panoramic windows at every level. Between the towers, vast window panes bathed the terminal with natural light and provided views across the airfield. It was only when you got close to the terminal that you realised just how tall the building was. It was much taller than any railway station. The towers acted as masts, tethers and boarding platforms for the airships. When she had arrived, 7 of the towers were occupied, with the giant ships clinging onto the building like skin tags. The terminal had been another triumph for Charles Holden. His inclination for curves, natural light and space were completely in tune with the feeling of airship travel. She had read that entering the terminal was the first step to prepare the traveller for the unreal feeling of floating in the air with glass panoramas of the world passing by beneath. She had arrived early so that she had plenty of time to explore the building and enjoy the amenities. She admired the curved lampshades that evoke the distinctive shape of an airship. She spotted the famous Imperial Airways logo of 2 crossed airships worked into the wood panelling. Someone had long ago christened this design Blimps Rampant, and this name had stuck. But what absolutely captivated her was the giant globe at the centre of the terminal. It hung from the ceiling and showed daytime and night across the world. More impressively, it pinpointed the location of British airships as they made their way across oceans and between continents. London was at the heart of a dense network that now extended to the furthest flung corners of the empire. She was shaken from her daydreams by a more urgent sounding announcement. Imperial Airships voyage to Sydney via Cairo, Calcutta and Kuala Lumpur is now boarding. Any remaining passengers for flight R116, please make your way to gate number 4 immediately. She rushed across the terminal and joined the back of a queue that was quickly moving forward towards the tower. Lifts whisked 20 passengers at a time to the embarkation platform, where they were greeted by a steward ushering them inside the airship. Once inside, they were taken to their cabins and invited to join the captain for a drink in the main saloon. She was torn between a strong desire to go and explore the whole ship and wanting to meet the other passengers. In the end, she decided to be social. After all, she'd have plenty of time to explore on her journey halfway across the world. The saloon was breathtaking. Her whole house and garden could easily fit in a corner. The brochure had proudly declared it the largest open space in the skies, comfortably seating all 200 passengers with plenty of space for lounge chairs, tables, a bar, grand piano, and even a small stage for the evening entertainment. She looked around, taking in all of the intricate lacquered detailing in the opulent wooden panelling. Brass fittings tastefully uplit the room, giving this huge space a surprisingly intimate feel. On the floor, a stunning carpet highlighted flowers and trees from across the empire. Roses gave way to poppies, oaks and elms wove between maples and banyans, golden wattles and cowries from Australasia clustered in the corners, and she found herself stood on the petals of South Africa's giant pink protea. "Is this your first time?" She looked up in surprise and found herself opposite a dark-haired young man in white tie. "Excuse me," she said. "Is this your first time, you know, on an airship? Only you've been gawping at everything for at least 10 minutes. He smiled and she felt her face flush red. "I'm sorry, that was terribly rude. Can I make it up to you by getting you a drink?" At 6:36 on the 4th of October 1930, the world's largest airship slipped the mast at Cardington and floated into the sky. 7.5 hours later, she ploughed into the undulating countryside just south of Beauvais in northern France. R101 burst into flames and within minutes became a blazing wreck. Historian John Swinfield notes that there was nothing left at the crash site but a blackened skeleton, a vast tangle of steel looking like the cremated remains of a prehistoric mammoth. Of the 54 people on board, only 8 survived the initial impact. 2 of those succumbed to their injuries, leaving just 6 passengers alive to tell their story. The only outside witness to the airship's spectacular demise was George Rabouy, a 56-year-old factory worker and poacher who was out late setting traps for rabbits. He described how the giant ship slowly sank towards Earth before making contact and exploding with such force that it sent him flying backwards. In a special 6 a.m. edition of the Sunday Times, the first details of the crash trickled out to the general public. At 4:30 a.m, as the reporter telephoned in his story, the airship was still on fire despite the storm raging about. Amongst the dead were the Secretary of State for Air, the Director of Airship Development, and the Director of Civil Aviation. Alongside them were the engineers, technicians, and designers who had made the airship a reality. There have been plenty of theories about what caused the catastrophic failure of R101. Some have highlighted the sheer complexity of the project, likening it to the interwar equivalent of the Apollo program. Others focus on the clash of personalities, the rival airship designs, and inter-service rivalries as providing the ingredients for disaster. One of the most eye-catching theories centres on Lord Thompson's flying carpet. The Air Minister insisted on taking a fine Persian rug. Sir Peter Masefield's forensic investigation of the crash in his book To Rise the Storm includes a quotation.
"You know, I can't help feeling that the carpet loaded at the nose may have tipped the balance. Not on its own, of course, but added to all the other things when the critical moment came." Whether the carpet did tip the balance, it was clear that the ship was heavily laden. Sir Peter Masefield writes that the Secretary of State for Air drove to Cardington that night with a van full of luggage. When she slipped the mooring tower at Cardington, thousands of gallons of water ballast had to be dropped to try and lift her nose into the sky. All of this might have been surmountable in perfect weather, but R101 was not to be so fortunate. Light drizzle and a gentle breeze gave way to pounding rain and wrenching headwinds. R101 was not so much gliding into a bright future as lugubriously struggling to avoid the ground.
A million people lined the streets in London for a funeral cortege of the 48 people who died in the disaster. In the end, Lord Thompson's own hopeful words, written before the flight, seem tragically prescient. R100 gave me pleasure. R101 will, I hope, give me joy. To ride the storm has always been my ambition. Britain now joined a group of countries who had shelved experiments with airships following terrible disasters. France had been an early victim with the destruction of the Dumont in 1923. The USA followed in 1933, following the loss of the Akron. Germany was now the only country left running and developing airships. In the coming years, they would develop a new class of Zeppelins that were even bigger than the R101 had been. They were the Hindenburg class. The flagship would meet its infamous and very public demise in 1937. Passengers would eventually take to the skies in their millions, but this future belonged to the airplane rather than the airship. Thanks for listening to the Almost History podcast. I'd really like to hear from you. Let me know what you think of the programme and what you'd like to hear more of. If you like the podcast, please take a moment to rate or review it on iTunes or your favourite podcast service. The theme music is Newsroom by Riot. All of the other music featured on this episode is detailed in the episode description. Don't forget, you can find out far more about Almost History from almosthistorypodcast.com. And from Almost History, we're almost done.